So if you've got your Bibles with you here tonight, we're going to get started off. We're going to really just take off right where we left off last week in the book of 1 Samuel. We're going to go to chapter 13. I'll give you a little bit of background about last week. So last week we primarily focused on some lessons that we learned from Samuel himself. And then by the end of the lesson, we kind of gave an introduction on who Saul was, right? The first king, right? A Benjaminite. How he was described as tall and a goodly in appearance, goodly in mannerism also. And that he was mighty, he was strong. He was basically everything that you would think a person would want in a king, right? He was, as we might say today, very popular, very well-liked, easy to like, in fact. You may remember that God, through Samuel, however, warns the people. He warns the people on what kind of things a human king will bring, what he'll do. He reminds them that a human king could never live up to, could never equate to the promises and the things that God has been as their king, as their leader. But still, they want someone who they can see, who they can speak to face to face. And so they want this human king as their leader to be like all the other nations. Well, Saul was that man. Saul was the first. Now, as I was thinking about this, something interesting came to my mind that really is kind of an obvious thing, but I guess I really never kind of thought about it in this way. Something about Saul. Saul was in a very unique situation, or should I say an opportunity. Saul, as the first king of Israel, he had an opportunity to set the bar, so to speak. An opportunity to set the standard that all of the kings that would follow after him should live up to, right? An opportunity to say, this is what the king of God's people should be. This is how we should act. This is how I should love. This is what my mannerism should be. And that's kind of a nice thing, although it's a very serious weight, a very serious responsibility, of being the first to do something, right? You set the standard. He had an opportunity there. Now, there's a number of lessons that we're going to learn from Saul and his story throughout the biblical narrative. And in fact, even in the New Testament, some of the apostles make reference to Saul. But before we get into all of that, I want us to take a look at what Saul's going to do. And the first thing I want to talk to you about is Saul, he had some character flaws. All right, we're going to talk about these character flaws and how they affected him, how they affected his relationship, how they affected the people that he was placed over as king. And to begin that, again, turn your Bibles, if you're not there yet, to 1 Samuel 13. Now, at this time, where we come into the Scripture, Saul has been king for about 2 years. All right, he's been king for about 2 years. He was anointed king, and then the Philistines and the surrounding nations have constantly been pressing against Israel. They've been attacking them, and Israel has been attacking them back. I'm kind of fighting back, right? That's one of the things that Israel wanted. That's one of the reasons they wanted Saul. They thought that if they had a king, they'd have someone to fight their battles, to go before them, to free them from the Philistines, to free them from the Amalekites. However, the Philistines, they've ensured, as we read in the chapter here, that the Philistines don't have any blacksmiths. They're not able to work iron or to make weapons. And the reason is they're concerned that they might turn their pruning hooks, they might turn their rakes or their shovels into weapons. And so if they need to sharpen any of their farming or agricultural implements, they have to go to the Philistines, who are basically the ones that are over them at this time, and get their implements sharpened. That way they thought they could prevent them. So that's the kind of thing that they're dealing with right now, right? They're not really a free people. They have people lording over them and encroaching them and holding them back, restraining them. So here's what happens, all right? We're going to get into this here in just a second. Saul is about to attack the Philistines at Gilgal. But before they can engage in battle, they need to sacrifice unto the Lord. This is a lesson that Israel learned a long time ago. And they learned this lesson, as we were talking about. You might remember the story of what happened at Jericho, this great victory. And then after that comes their great defeat at Ai, right? Jericho, they very much were depending in obedience upon the Lord. Ai, they were trusting in their own strength, their own arms. They became prideful. They learned back then, if they want to be victorious, they need to have God on their side. God needs to go before them. So they knew that they needed to take a sacrifice before they could go and attack. And so, here's what's happening. as you may know, we've talked about this a couple of times, still in the background here before we jump in. Who was it, church? Who was it that had to make the sacrifices for Israel? Could anyone just go in and make the sacrifice, or were there some rules that were laid down? There were some rules, right? It had to be a priest. It had to be a priest. Now, not only did it have to be a priest, but what we're seeing here is an atonement offering, all right? And there's only one person that could make the atonement offering. That's the high priest, which is a role that's being fulfilled by Samuel at this time. And so the people are waiting on Samuel to come to perform this, and they've been waiting for a number of days. Now, I want you to begin with me here. We're going to read in verse 8 here. I want to see what happens. It says, "And he tarried," this is speaking of Samuel, "7 days, according to the set time that Samuel had appointed." In other words, he told them that he would be about 7 days. "But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him." All right, people were all over the place. They were scattered about. It had been 7 days. He didn't show up when he said he was. But Saul is the king. They're looking to Saul for leadership. They're, "Hey, are we going to do this? What's the plan? Samuel's not here. There's the Philistines. What are we going to do?" So Saul, maybe he buckled the pressure. Maybe it was his own pride. Maybe he had a desire to keep the people around him happy. Maybe he was worried that what they thought was more important than what God thought. I don't know. We're going to talk about it here in a second. But listen to what happens. "And Saul said, bring hither the burnt offering to me and peace offerings." Now, what are peace offerings for? What's the burnt offering for? These are atonement offerings. In other words, this is to get right with God in case there be any sin in the camp, amongst the people, before they go into battle. Why? So that the presence of the Lord will be among them, so that God will go before them. That's the purpose, right? In other words, can Saul do that? Is Saul a Levite? Is Saul a priest? No. We've talked about this last week. Saul is a Benjaminite. He is not a priest. He is not a Levite. He is not who God says has to do this. Now, what happens? He says, "Bring them to me." And then it goes on. "And he offered the burnt offering. And it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what hast thou done?" Now, before we move on here, I want to pause right there real quick. Isn't that kind of figure? Isn't that kind of the way life goes for us too? 7 days they've been waiting for Samuel. Finally, Saul, feeling like he's got to make a decision, makes a decision. It's the wrong one. And as soon as he does it, oh, look, there's Samuel. Here he comes. Great timing, Samuel. Glad you're here, right? Can you imagine what Saul was thinking when, as soon as he does this thing, now here comes Samuel? You guys ever felt like that? Huh? You ever felt like, and you're in a hurry? Every red light is red now because you need to be somewhere, right? Or as soon as you're late, now suddenly all the lights are green. Okay, awesome. Now that truck that was in my way going 5 miles an hour through the mountain, that thing turned off as soon as it was too late for me to get to work on time. That's basically what just happened here, right? We still experience things like this. Going on here, we're going to read one more verse here. "And Saul said," now he's just Saul explaining, right? Because Samuel comes up and he sees this and he goes, "Saul, what have you done?" In other words, Samuel knows that he shouldn't have done this, and Saul knew it too. And we know Saul knew it, one, because he's of Israel, he's the king, there's no way he didn't know the laws. But listen to what he says, his reasoning. "And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattered from me." In other words, the people were beginning to lose faith in me. They were starting to back out. I was losing them. I have this army we need to attack. If I didn't do something soon, if they didn't see action, I was losing my army. They were starting to, okay, nothing's going on. We're not going to be able to do this. He said, so I did this for them so we could go, so they'd have trust. He says, and that thou camest not within the days appointed. He goes, it's your fault. You were late. And that the Philistines, they gathered themselves together at Michmash. I'm not even sure I'm saying that right. Michmash. Sure. So basically, he says, look, Samuel, I know this isn't what God said to do. I know this is outside of our rules, outside of our laws. But the Philistines are here. They're gathered together. And if we don't do something, they're just going to sweep over us. My army's starting to disappear. You were late. I had to do something, so I took it into my own hands. After all, I'm the king. I made a decision, is basically what he's saying. And he's blaming everybody else. The people were scattering, and you didn't come on time, and the Philistines were here. Here's something I want us to take a look at. Normally, we might think to ourselves that this seems like a reasonable thing. We might put ourselves in this position and say, well, was he just supposed to wait forever? What we see here is that they already understand, we've talked about this, that without God, they cannot be victorious. I want you, though, to see something. And this is something that you think they would have learned by now. It is better to not fight than to fight without God. It is better to not fight than to fight without God. And that's the lesson here. By our earthly reasoning, we look at all the things that's going on and we say, okay, I can see that Saul's in a pretty difficult situation there, right? He's in a pretty precarious situation. This is that time when he has to decide what's more important to him. Keep the people pleased. It also shows us where his trust is. Is his trust in him and the army to defend Israel, or is his trust in God to defend Israel? Is his trust in himself to lead and to do things, or is his trust in God to lead and to do things? In other words, who does Saul represent as king? Is Saul representing himself and the people, or is Saul a representative of God to the people? Do you see the difference in those two things? It's all about what Saul's mind was in this. Saul was not being a godly-minded king. He was being a self-minded king, because to him, he represented himself, and Israel represented him, and he represented Israel. What he forgot, though, is that his purpose as king was to lead the people in God's ways, God's orders, God's will, for God's glory. He missed that. He made it about his wants, his desires, his pride, and that's why all these things concerned him. If he truly trusted in God, would he have been concerned about these Philistines, these same Philistines whom God has used many judges to attack and to conquer many times? Would he be concerned about them coming and taking over the people of God? No. It was all excuses. He made a rash decision because of his pride. That's what it comes down to. Now, join me. We're at verse 12. Let's read 12 through 14, these two verses here, and listen to what happens. This is what Samuel says about this. Therefore said I, this is Samuel, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. This is still Saul. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering. Now here's Samuel. And Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. In other words, he's saying, Saul, you fool. You fool. You thought that you were fit to make decisions. You thought that you could decide what was right and what was wrong. You thought that you knew best rather than trusting God. God would have established your family as the line of kings for here forever. He could have used you forever. You had that opportunity. You've ruined it, Saul. You've not chose to serve God. Clearly, your trust isn't in him. He goes on, though. He says, but now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee. So, soon after these events, here's what takes place, and we're about to get to our first application here. Saul attacks the Philistines and attacks the Amalekites. So we've already seen what happened here with the Philistines at Gilgal with this sacrifice that was not meant to be, this sacrifice that was not done in accordance to God's word. Well, now we're talking about a separate event that comes a little while after. He fights with the Amalekites, and he has instructions, right? He has specific instructions that Samuel's given him from God, and his instructions went something like this. When you go and you fight with them, you are to kill every man, woman, child, livestock, everything. In other words, you are to absolutely eradicate them. Wipe these people from the land. That was his instruction from God. And we may look at that and think, wow, that is cold. That's terrible. No mercy at all. But what we lack, what we fail to remember, and I want to remind you of this, God wasn't just giving and delivering Israel. He was also judging the inhabitants of the land. All right, they were never going to stop the terrible things that they were doing. God was not only removing them in mercy, but also in judgment. Okay, mercy to those to whom they were doing these terrible things, but also judgment on them for doing them. So keep that in mind when you see God give commandments like that. So anyways, he tells them what they're to do. He says that they're to destroy them. However, here's what happens. Saul disobeys. He does not wipe out every man, woman, and child. In fact, here's what he actually does. He takes the king of the Amalekites as a prisoner. Then he takes all of their money, their wealth, their possessions, in addition to their livestock, their cattle, their goats, their sheep, all of that. And he keeps all of these things. Now, here's the thing. When Saul is asked why, because Samuel, like before, suddenly shows up. Isn't it strange how God always shows up right whenever we think he's not looking? That's kind of what happens here, right? Well, no big deal. Samuel's not here. We got to make a decision. Here's what I'm going to do. I know I should, but I'm going to do this. Every time it's right after he does what's wrong that suddenly Samuel shows up. I kind of see a little bit of the truth there of how God is. God's always here, even though we may not think that he's not looking, that he doesn't know. God knows. God sees what you're doing. God sees what I'm doing. He sees how what we say. He knows what's going on in our hearts. You can't hide it, right? And that's how come Samuel just happens to show up every time Saul does something like this. Now, here's where we come into our first application piece here. When he's asked about this, Saul says that he brought the animals to be sacrifices. But that, I have a problem with that understanding here. He says that he took them to sacrifice to God, but here's the thing. First of all, they have to be a certain type of animal, not just any animal will do. Secondly, do you think God is going to accept a sacrifice to him if what you're sacrificing is what he told you to kill already? You see, it's not a sacrifice if you're not giving, for one. The sacrifices was to be from the people to give to God. If you take it from someone else, you've given nothing of yourself. So first of all, it defeats the whole purpose of the sacrifice. Second, in doing this, he disobeyed the commandment of God. So two things. Now, moving on here. Here's what we see. I want you to see something here. The reason that we need a sacrifice and the reason that they need a sacrifice was what? We've talked about this. The reason we need the sacrifice is to remove sin. As we remove sin, it allows us to come into the presence of God and for God to be where we are without us being judged, without us being under that condemnation, right? Disobedience, however, is sin, which separates us from God. So you can't make a sacrifice in disobedience to God. So application point is this. Obedience is better than sacrifice. Obedience is better than sacrifice. And Samuel gives us this lesson, chapter 15, verse 22. Samuel says this. And Samuel said, Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices? In other words, he's asking a question to him. He's asking a question to Saul. He says, does or hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? In other words, what do you think God delights in more? When you make a sacrifice to him to remove sins that you've committed? When you have to kill something to take a life for what you've done? Do you think he delights in that? Or do you think he delights more in the obedience to God, which prevents sin, which prevents barriers, which prevents separation, and glorifies him in your life because you are obeying his will over yours? That's the question basically he's asking. He goes, which one do you think it is that he wants more? Which one do you think brings him more joy, more glory? Which one do you think he desires? And then he answers that question. Behold, or look, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. And so that's our first application point. Yes, it's true that because we have the blood of Jesus Christ, We are forgiven, past, present, future, for anything that we say or do. All of our failings, God has forgiven us for them. But as Paul said, does that mean that we should sin more, that we should continue in sin, that grace may abound? God forbid. In other words, God is more pleased when we obey him, and that it is, you can see in the life of the believer that God is the priority, God is the treasure, God is your focus, rather than the sacrifice that's made. Obedience is better than sacrifice. That's our first point of application, and we see that from his life here. Now, the second thing is, this is one that I really want to kind of hunker down on here. Yeah, probably for the majority of the rest of the message here. This is a big one that I think we need to see. And I've spoken on this, I think, one time before, but it was a while back. I want to point out a couple things about Saul before we get into this. You may remember that Saul actually started out really well. He really did. Remember how I told you when we were studying about Saul that he was goodly, right? He had a good character, good appearance, well-known, mighty, all these things. But he also seemed to be goodly in his relationship, because it was right after this time that we hear that the Spirit of God came upon him and that he prophesied greatly. He went down with the other prophets who were praising the Lord with their cymbals and their lyres and all of these instruments, and he joined in with them as he's singing praises to God, clearly worshiping, clearly glorifying, clearly blessed, clearly the hand of God upon him. We see these things. And now you're beginning to see some of those character flaws that are in him. Beloved, every one of us here tonight, we've all got character flaws. We've all got things that we have to wrestle with if we're going to be obedient unto God. We've all got things that we've got to say, no, God says this, I need to trust in this, I need to obey this, I need to do this. We're all going to have those times of struggle. Saul didn't wrestle well, so to speak. He gave in, primarily to pride. He gave in to pride, he became greedy, he became jealous, power hungry, to name a couple of the things that we see throughout his story here. And in fact, the story with David, and many of you know the story, I would bet that probably everyone here knows the story of David. Saul became so jealous of David, of his kind demeanor, especially when he understands that he's going to be the next king. He becomes jealous, angry, wants to take his life, wants to kill David. Even though David's done nothing but been a blessing to this man, David, in fact, would play the harp for him to calm him and served him as a general of his army, was going to marry his daughter Michal, or Michal as it's pronounced. So David's done nothing wrong, but Saul wants to kill him. So here's what ends up happening. David and a small group of men, they flee, they run. They run away. Why? Because David's life is in jeopardy if he stays around Saul. Saul is not open to reason. Saul is, who was once a good man. We've seen this decline steadily into madness, really, from where he was. At first, he was just trying to do right and made some bad decisions. Then pride got in. Then he became power hungry. Then he became jealous of David. Then he became wanting to take his life. Now he's become basically a man who wants to murder someone who's done nothing but bless him. And really, this is a rejection of God. Because let's be honest, who is it that's placing David as the next king? God. So when Saul tries to stop that by killing David, that's his hope, right? What's he hoping to do? He's trying to deny what God has said is going to come to pass. He is rejecting what God has deemed will come to pass. In other words, he's rejecting the sovereignty of God. Big problem. So you can see that Saul has fallen far from where he began. But it didn't just happen overnight. It didn't just happen. He didn't just go from a good Christian man trying to do the right thing, a servant of God, loving the Lord, serving in every way, to one day he just woke up and lost his mind. That's not what happened. Our lesson here, our principle of application, and we're going to get into this a little bit more, quite a bit more actually, sin is gradual. Sin is gradual. It was once told to me in this way, and I'll share it with you, the illustration that was made. Everyone here who's ever driven a car, you guys ever had a flat tire? Most of the time when you get a flat, when you're driving down the road, you don't just come, and it doesn't just blow out. Suddenly it goes from a perfectly good tire to just poof, gone. That's not how it happens. You get a nail in there. Something penetrates it. Something gets in. Something's allowed to pierce what you were riding on. Something that pierces what you had. And slowly the air, which I would say represents in this illustration God or His Spirit, closeness with Him, begins to leak out. As that happens, as that air leaks out of the tire, the ride isn't so smooth anymore, is it? That represents your life. It starts to get kind of bumpy. You begin to hear it. You begin to notice it in the ride itself. Start to experience a lot of difficulty. Next thing you know, you're having problems with control. You're having problems with the speed. Everything's going kind of wrong. And before long, all the air is out. The tire's flat. You really can't go anywhere without causing some serious damage, if you can go anywhere at all. Sin is the same way. That nail represents sin. And that sin, if you don't deal with it, causes the Spirit of God, causes the relationship with God to suffer. And it's a slow fade. Sin is, our relationship with God very rarely is just, it completely drops out. It very rarely is just a blowout. Sin is a slow leak. There's a slow fade into depravity if we don't deal with it. And that's what we see in the life of Saul. So if there's sin in your life, if there's sin in my life, it's important that we acknowledge it and that we deal with it. Otherwise, there's going to be a whole lot more air, a whole lot more damage to the relationship. And as that happens, not only does it damage our lives, our ride becomes a lot more bumpy, but it really is hard to get back to where we need to be because we've done so much damage. I want to now show you a couple of things here to display this with a story of what happens with Saul. I want to show you the depths to which we see Saul's depravity, right? So, as David and his men are fleeing, they come across a temple. Now, his men haven't eaten in a while. They're very hungry, at least 3 days, if I remember correctly. They come across a temple, and there are Levites there, priests, and of course they know David. They know David is, I mean, David's a very famous figure, right? He's not only a great general, a great warrior, all of the people know him, they love him, they adore him, they know him also as the son-in-law of the king, right? I told you he's going to marry Michal, the king's daughter. He's very well known, so of course they know who this is. And so, what would you do? They did the exact same thing that I would do. They take him in. What can we do for you, servant of the king? What, you're hungry. All we have is the showbread. But you can have the showbread. Eat the showbread. So they give him food. They wish him well on his way. In fact, they even give him a sword. All right. In fact, they give him the sword of Goliath, which was placed there after David killed him many years ago. But they give him that sword. And they say, this is yours anyway. You know, take it and go. And they leave. Word gets back to Saul of where David is, because Saul is hunting him. Remember, Saul wants to kill him. Saul is hunting him down. Saul hears that he'd stopped at this temple. Word comes to him. Saul takes a band of men and goes to this temple. And I want you to see what happens here as he investigates. He calls out the leader of the Levites to speak on behalf of the priest. Hey, come out here, talk with me. And so he comes out. And that's where we pick up in 1 Samuel chapter 22. So we're going to pick up at 1 Samuel chapter 22. We're going to begin at verse 13. All right, we're going to read about 5 verses here of the story of what takes place. And I think that you'll be shocked at what happens. And this is in order to show you the depths to which the sin will lead, the depravity, how far we can fall. Remember where he began, beginning in verse 13. And Saul said unto him, this is that priest who came out to speak with him. Saul says, why have you conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, speaking of David, in that, in other words, here's what you did. You have given him bread and a sword and has inquired of God for him. In other words, so you gave him food, you gave him weaponry, and you prayed to God on his behalf that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this very day? Then Ahimelech, that's the priest who came out, that's who he's speaking to, responds. He answered the king, and he said, "And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David?" Clearly, he's confused. He's saying, "What are you talking about? Conspired against you with David, the son of Jesse? My king, who is more faithful to you than David? You think that David's conspiring against you? You think that I've conspired against you in helping the best and greatest servant that you have? Which also is the king's son-in-law and goeth at thy bidding." In other words, he does everything that you ask him to do. He's your right-hand man and is honorable in thine house. Clearly, he's confused. He says, he goes on, "Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father. For thy servants knew nothing of all this, less or more." In other words, he's saying, "Now, king, I prayed on his behalf, but not that he would overthrow you. I don't know of any issues between you and David. I have every reason to believe until just now that you and David are on great terms, not just good, but outstanding." In other words, who would you be on better terms with? What do you mean? Please don't accuse me of any unrighteous thing. I know nothing of what you're talking about. So clearly, this priest doesn't know what he's talking about, and it sounds like the priest has a real accurate view of what's happening. Let's watch what King Saul does. "Then the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, Turn, slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord." In other words, and I think you can see this already, but I'll explain it just to be concise. He says, "Oh, okay, sure, you didn't know anything about it. You're just doing what you should do. Okay, yeah. I don't care that you're a priest of the Lord. I'm going to kill you and every single one of you, all the priests of this temple. I'm going to wipe you out." And he tells his men to take their lives. His men, think about this. Now, this is courage. I've got a lot of respect for these men here just in this story. They face to face defied the king and said, "No, we will not fall upon, put our hands on, we will not kill the priests of the Lord." In other words, they're looking at him like, "Are you crazy? These are holy men. These are priests. You want us to murder them? What?" Listen to how Saul responds to this. You would think that a reasonable person who really has God at their heart, that would be a warning to them, that would make them snap out of it. Wait a minute. Yeah, you're right. What am I talking about? Let's see if that's what happens with Saul. "And the king said to Doeg, Turn thou and fall upon the priests." By the way, Doeg is an Edomite, all right? Doeg is not one of the people of Israel. And Doeg the Edomite turned, and he fell upon the priests and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. 85. They are defenseless priests. They have no weaponry. It was one man. They had nowhere to run. They were in the temple. They had to go through the door to get out. And he killed and murdered 85 priests of the Lord that day by the king's command. It's not done yet, though. As if to look at that, if that doesn't show you the depths of which sin can lead in depravity, to know where Saul began, it doesn't end there, folks. Moving on here. 19. "And Nob, the city of the priests," in other words, where they lived, where their families were, where their people were, "smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women and children, sucklings, oxen, asses, sheep, with the edge of the sword." So Saul, their king, these are Levite priests, his priests, he then goes to Nob, one of their cities full of their people, Saul's people, and instructs them to wipe them out. Man, woman, child, livestock. He basically destroys his own people, his own countrymen. Are you seeing it? Are you seeing the depravity? Are you seeing what sin can lead to? Why? Because he refused to acknowledge that he was wrong. He refused to acknowledge his pride. He refused to acknowledge God's will. He saw things one way and he refused to open his eyes. He wouldn't even listen to the pleading of his own men when they said, "We're not going to do this." No. What began as pride turned to disobedience, then jealousy, then hatred, then murder, and then the genocide, really, of his own people, mass murder of his own people, innocents, women, children. Here's the lesson. Sin often starts small. We try to justify it. We deny that it's even sin. Eventually, it corrupts us further and further if we do not resist it. I want to give you a quote by John Owen. This is probably the best and most accurate quote, and this is only a portion of it. It's actually a much larger quote. He gives an entire dissertation, a theological dissertation, on this very notion of what sin is and how it grows. Listen to this first little paragraph here. John Owen, and I quote, "Sin aims always at the utmost. Every time that it rises up to tempt or to entice, if it has its own way, it will go out to the utmost sin in that kind. Every unclean thought or glance would be adultery if it could. Every thought of unbelief would be atheism if allowed to develop. Every rise of lust, if it has its way, reaches the height of villainy. It is like the grave that is never satisfied. The deceitfulness of sin is that it is modest, small, it's a little thing, in its first proposals. But when it prevails, it hardens men's hearts and brings them to ruin." End quote. I could never have said that more elegantly, more accurately, or more honestly. That's exactly how sin is in our lives. And that's also why if we continue in sin, if we continue to do things, after a while the conviction begins to go away. We begin to not feel bad about it. Why? Because it's like more, wanting more, wanting more. And that's what he's talking about, how it grows and it grows and it grows. So that's the second thing. Sin is a slow fade and it eventually leads to our ruin. Sin is a slow fade and it leads to our ruin. Last thing I want to talk to you about, we'll move through this quickly because we're short on time here tonight. The last thing is, we've talked about, and I think you've seen by this point, Saul's character, right? We see what has happened to Saul, how his character's changed, the length of which it has gone to. We've understand now what's going on and why these things have happened. Now I want to give you a little snippet, a little glimpse at David's character, right? Here's the difference between Saul, the first king, who represents Adam, by the way, and David, who represents Christ, right? He's a Christ figure. Notice the first, the second. All right, so David soon hears what Saul has done at the city of Nob with the priests and their families. You can imagine how heartbroken he is. Remember, David is a man after God's own heart. He's a servant of God. You can imagine how this strikes him. I can only imagine the anger that he must have, not only at what's happened, but for those families. And after a short time, Saul continues tracking down David, and they come to a cave. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 24. We're going to read 4 verses, right? Begin in verse 2. Sorry, my math is bad. We're going to read 5 verses. 1 Samuel 24, verses 2 to 7, and then we'll give you one application point here, and we'll close out. "Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats." In other words, he went into the wild seeking him, had a search party, 3,000 men. "And he came by the sheepcotes, came to the sheepcotes, by the way, where was a cave. And Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave." In other words, they were tracking them, and he didn't realize that the very cave that he had come to, tracking David, is where David and his men were actually at, hiding in there. So he goes in there. He goes into this cave, and he lets his guard down, right? He lets his guard down. He's not paying attention. David and his men are in this cave somewhere. And the men of David said unto him, but so David and his men see this is Saul. This is the king. He's in here, and he's pretty much alone in the cave, right? Behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. In other words, his men are now agging him on. They're kind of encouraging him. Look, he's by himself. He's in the cave. He has no idea we're here. This is it. God said he'd deliver your enemy unto you. Go take care of it. This is what God wants. Kind of pressuring him. Go take care of it right now, right? Go take the throne. Then David arose, and he cut off the skirt. So he cut a piece of cloth off of his robe, over his skirt, of Saul's robe privily, secretly, quietly. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. In other words, even that bothered him, that he had even cut his garment. And he said unto his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So what just happened here? David had an opportunity to take what he wanted. He had an opportunity to end what he'd been battling with, to put his mind and his heart at ease. Very easy it would have been for him just to take what he wanted, which was the throne, which he's promised to him, and peace, also to avenge all of the things that Saul has done, to remove a tyrant from the throne. But what did David say? No, 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 no. I can't do this. Why? His heart. And this is why God loved David. His heart was, I will not take the throne. I will not take Saul's life. I will not do this. God will deal with Saul, not David. God will put David on the throne, not David. God will avenge the people of Nob, not David. God will avenge his priests, not David. In other words, David's trust was absolutely, confidently, securely in God. He didn't worry about Saul taking his life. He wasn't that concerned about when or how he was going to become king. He wasn't worried about avenging them. David's heart, his trust, was at this time 100% invested in God. He understood that God was sovereign. He understood that God had a plan. He understood that nothing was happening that God didn't ordain. And he also knew that God told him he would be king. David didn't need to act. That's where Saul went wrong. Saul thought that, well, God's not here. Samuel's not here to do the sacrifice. Well, I'm king. I got to decide what to do. And Saul took things into his own hands. He represented Adam, not David. David represented Christ. David represents God. What does he do? He trusts. He trusts in God to deliver him, to deliver the people, to make good on his promises. We see a very, very stark contrast in these two kings, these two men. Let me ask you this in closing tonight. Where's your trust? Where's my trust? When we're in the depths of despair, when we're in fear, when we're hurting, when we don't understand something, when we're dealing with, struggling with something, look at what David went through. His life was on the line. He was running in his own land from a man whom he loved. Do you, do I, trust God knows best, even when it doesn't feel like it's what's best? That's the question. Here's your application point. Even amidst evil times and evil people, even during difficult situations, fear, distress, or panic, trust that God is in control and that he is working all things for his purpose. And I put a little quick note here and then we'll close out in prayer. I think that the songwriter who wrote Trust and Obey understood this. Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus than to trust and obey. When you don't understand, when I don't understand, that's all right. Trust and obey. Join me as we close in prayer.